This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello and welcome to Powerhouse Politics. I'm ABC News Chief White House Correspondent Jonathan Carl.
And I'm ABC News Political Director Rick Klein.
13 days until November 3rd, Rick. One day until the next and final presidential debate. A debate I have to candidly admit to you I did not think was actually going to happen, and I probably won't believe is going to happen until it starts. But here we are. And I just thought that, and by the way, we have a great guest coming up. We're going to be talking to General H.R. McMaster, a very thoughtful guy with a distinguished military career, who also happened to serve as President Trump's second national security advisor. We'll be talking to him shortly. But Rick, I mean, you're a student of politics. You know this stuff as well as anybody. You know what closing arguments are all about. It has been interesting to me to watch the president make his closing case. I would have thought maybe he would have done something about its stewardship of the economy, maybe, you know, play up his vision for a second term. But what I have noticed here is the president has gone hard at a couple of, well, a few people I really wouldn't have thought he would have gone after. One, Dr. Anthony Fauci. I want to play a little bit of that back and forth, because there has been a back and forth to that. He's apparently going after Leslie Stahl and CBS and 60 Minutes. He's gone hard at Savannah Guthrie and Kristen Welker at NBC. He said a couple things about ABC, but not as much, maybe because of the ratings of our town hall with Joe Biden. This is a rather strange closing set of arguments.
And it is not the way that the campaign staff has scripted it. The campaign staff has been telling us for weeks, the American people are dialed into Amy Coney Barrett and the Supreme Court confirmations. They're dialed into the economy as the overriding issue. They're dialed into alleged corruption by the Biden family. Those are the things that they want to be talking about. The things, though, that President Trump is talking about are different, and it's not. In some cases, they make no sense. I mean, I don't think there's really a good political explanation for picking a fight with Dr. Fauci at this stage of the campaign, given where the public polling numbers are for both of those men. But there is kind of a bedrock reliance that the president has about what animates his base, his people, and those rallies that he views as his own focus groups and his own gauge of where America is at any given moment are eating it up. So the only way to me to describe it is that Trump will continue to run the way he always has, and that is in listening to and stoking the anxieties and the fears and the rallying cries of a very loyal base.
So there's also one other thing before we get to the Fauci back and forth. The money angle. Now, look, I've covered a lot of campaigns, including one 4 years ago, where the candidate with the most money does not win. Those are exceptions, by the way, to the usual trend. But the Trump campaign raised, and if you combine it with the super PACs, the party, all the kind of pro-Trump money out there, they raised like a $1.5 billion, and they're going into the final 2 weeks with on fumes.
Less than $200 million of that left.
Yeah, total. This and is everything. Not. I mean, the
total
campaign,
all
much,
of the. That's right.
Much less than
that's
that.
That's right.
Now, look, Hillary Clinton outspent him about 2-1 all told, but here we are again, an incumbent president who raised plenty of money, but is facing a final stretch where they're making tough decisions about reducing ad buys and conserving resources. It's bizarre. What happened there?
Do you remember the Super Bowl, John? The Super Bowl was in was in January, maybe early February. It was the Democratic primaries were hot. There were no Republican primaries. President Trump dropped a $10 million ad buy on the Super Bowl.
That was pretty good.
Fast forward to the world. Yeah, it was very good. Very good. The ad that hit TVs this cycle, or that's relevant for the general election, game one of the World Series.
Joe
Biden had a
60-second
ad. World Series. Yeah. It's the World Series. It's the World Series, and Sam Elliott's voice intoning for Joe Biden.
There is so much we can do if we choose to take on problems and not each other, and choose a president who brings out our best. Joe Biden doesn't need.
It was pretty good. Big Lebowski, baby. Yeah.
Kind of a Morning in America type of ad. And it is, look, I don't think Donald Trump wins or loses because of money. I know that's going to be some of the analysis around this. But the fact that the Death Star, Brad Parscale's metaphor for this juggernaut, the Death Star basically blew itself up when it comes to the financing of this campaign. And it vastly underperformed. And it appears to have vastly underserved the candidate himself, who was forced this week to fly all the way to California to continue to raise money. The Biden campaign has more money than it knows what to do with. And when you combine it with the Democratic outside groups, they can play almost anywhere. It's allowed them to reach down ballot. I agree with you, John. Money doesn't determine everything, but the disparities in the airwaves are striking, and they're allowing the Democrats at this stage to play basically anywhere they want, and forcing Donald Trump and the GOP to play defense in lots of places that he never imagined he'd have to worry about.
I mean, I went through looking at some of the numbers in the states of the spending combined super PAC campaign and party, and it is unbelievable in some of these places. I mean, in Michigan, it was more than 3-1, almost 4-1. Democrats outspending Republicans, pro Biden ads over pro Trump ads in Florida, 2-1. That's not really where you want to be. But let's talk about this war on Fauci and a back and forth, because I think it is interesting. And Rick, you and I were just talking. If we could rewind a little bit, you remember when I was, a week ago Sunday, was anchoring This Week, and I had requested and thought that I had an agreement from the White House to have Fauci come on as my guest. Do you remember this?
Yeah, so this is fascinating to me. So this is, it was 10 days ago, and the time moves slow in the area of this. It was only 10 short days ago. you said on air that Dr. Fauci was not allowed to come on the program.
We had hoped to talk to Dr. Fauci about both the outbreak at the White House and across the country. He was more than willing to join us, but the White House wouldn't allow you to hear from the nation's leading expert on coronavirus. In fact, they wouldn't allow any of the medical experts on the president's own coronavirus task force to appear on this show.
And it ended with a Twitter back and forth with the vice president's press secretary, who serves as kind of the spokesperson or the gatekeeper for the task force, because Mike Pence is the head of the task force, saying that was not true. And you put that to bed with this. You go read the tweets, because you want a Twitter argument as cleanly as you ever can by producing the receipts. You had the email showing that you asked for not just Dr. Fauci, but any member of the task force. Fauci was not allowed on. But one point that Alyssa Farah and others were making is, well, he's going to be out lots of other places. And I don't know, John, I wonder if that had something to do with the fact that Anthony Fauci was on 60 Minutes a week later, and that Anthony Fauci, who knew that he was not allowed on your show, would give a whole series of subsequent interviews that, frankly, Donald Trump didn't love.
I mean, they were suddenly pressured to prove that they were not muzzling him, because I quite directly said they were muzzling him, and he was suddenly doing a series of high profile interviews, none more high profile than his interview on 60 Minutes, where he said he wasn't surprised the president got infected, that he attended a super spreader event, referring to the Amy Coney Barrett nomination event in the Rose Garden. He said he frankly didn't understand, the president's position on masks didn't really make any sense. So Fauci's statements provoked quite a torrent from the president of the United States, Perhaps most importantly, this campaign conference call, and I know this. Well, you guys may have heard this and been out there, but some of the background is important. This was the president giving essentially a pep talk to the campaign staff. It came after the New York Times had her front page story talking about how many of the president's political advisors are you know, really just kind of borderline depressed, thinking that the campaign's not going well. They're, you know, worried about the direction. And he wanted to, you know, to kind of prove that the campaign was raring to go. You know, he arranged this conference call. And the reason why we know about it is the campaign quietly let reporters covering the campaign know about the call. They gave reporters, many of them, the dial-in instructions so that we would be able to listen and record the president. So this wasn't like some secret recording of the campaign call. The campaign wanted this out because they thought it was going to be a nice pep talk. Well, the pep talk turned into a broadside against Dr. Fauci. And let me just, I want to do one somewhat extended clip because I this is Monday. I just believe this is one of the most remarkable things that you could hear in the closing weeks of a campaign, especially a campaign in the midst of a pandemic. Take a listen.
People are tired of hearing Fauci and all these idiots, these people that have gotten it wrong. Fauci's a nice guy. He's been here for 500 years. He called every one of them wrong. And he's like this wonderful guy, a wonderful sage telling us how. He said, do not wear a face mask. That's a number of months ago. He said, do not close it up to China. Don't. I have a list of 15 things this guy. And yet we keep him. Every time he goes on television, there's always a bomb. But there's a bigger bomb if you fire him. But Fauci's a disaster. I mean, this guy, if I listen to him, we have 500,000 deaths.
I mean, Fauci's a disaster. The guy that is the acknowledged top expert on infectious diseases in the federal government, in the country, really. The guy who's been a prominent member of the president's own coronavirus task force is a disaster, is an idiot. It's really something else. But driving this is this frustration from the president, not just in Fauci, but he's tired of this virus. He's tired of it. Listen to what he said at a campaign rally in Arizona this week.
Your state is doing great. You have a great governor, as you know, and your state is doing great with a pandemic. Pandemic. They're getting tired of the pandemic, aren't they? Getting tired of the pandemic. You turn on CNN, that's all they cover. COVID, COVID, pandemic, COVID, COVID, COVID. You know why? They're trying to talk everybody out of voting. People aren't buying at CNN, you dumb bastards. They're not buying it. That's all they talk about.
I mean, we're at well over 220,000 deaths. We have many states reaching record numbers of new infections and also new hospitalizations. And the president would just like it to go away. I mean, he's been talking an optimistic game. Let's get rid of this. One final one, Rick, was in Carson City, Nevada over the weekend, where he actually mocked Joe Biden for suggesting that he would listen to the scientists. Listen to this.
He will surrender your future to the virus. He's going to lock down. This guy wants to lock down. He'll listen to the scientists. If I listened totally to the scientists, we would right now have a country that would be in a massive depression. Instead of, we're like a rocket ship. Take a look at the numbers.
Yeah, take a rocket ship. Take a look at the numbers. I guess it depends which numbers you're looking at, Rick.
Yeah, I it does depend on that, and obviously a lot of people are not are still unemployed. The economy isn't where it needs to be. Schools are not open. People aren't living this in a way. I think it's been telling at times when the president is now using as an attack line that Joe Biden would listen to the scientists. He's also using as an attack line that politics would be boring if Joe Biden is president. I think Joe Biden approves of both of those messages. He did gladly run his reelection campaign on exactly that I will get back to boringness, normalcy, and I will listen to the scientists and get beyond this. The country has been through such a disruptive period of time to everyone's lives, literally everyone's lives these last 7 months. I think the president's right. People are sick of COVID. They're tired of it. but they want it to be over. And on this defining issue, the president just doesn't have credibility. His continued contradictions, only a week or so removed from his own return to the campaign trail, given his own diagnosis, easy to forget, he was himself a COVID patient just a week and a half ago. It's all startling, but it's also clarifying. And I think it sets up exactly the kind of race that it was probably going to be all along. The president isn't really running from COVID as much as he's now hoping that the country's on the other side of it and can see beyond it. And that's tough given the reality of 2020 in America.
And I'm going to head out in a bit to Nashville to be there in the debate, the last one. Of course, we know what went down in Cleveland. But the rule change announced by the commission is, I think, been misunderstood by some. It's not actually a mute button. It's an automatic turning off of the microphone from the control room. Kristen Welker, my friend and colleague at NBC, who's the moderator, is not going to have a mute button. She's not going to be able to, mute somebody out. But when the initial question is posed to Biden, for instance, Trump's microphone will be off for 2 minutes for that uninterrupted answer. When it goes to Trump, Biden's mic will be off for 2 minutes. But then, as you remember, the way these go is the initial question is given to a candidate, and then there's this 90 seconds of kind of follow-on discussion, and both mics are going to be open. So there's plenty of opportunity for the kind of talking over each other and whatnot. And also, by the way, just because your mic is off doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be quiet. So it'll be interesting to see how it goes. We just won't be able to hear so well the interjections, if there are interjections. But, I imagine the president, who knows? Who knows? I think that that there's a real sense within the Trump, the Trump team, that this is the last real chance, the really truly last real chance to change the trajectory of the race. But going into this, Rick, there is no debate prep. Biden's doing a heck of a lot of debate prep. He's been down for 3 days. I don't know that that's good, but the debate prep that Chris Christie was a big part of and talked about, that's not happening this time from the Trump side. He's going to go in there. He's going to go in like he always does, but in a more extreme version, operating from his gut.
And John, almost 40 million Americans have voted. 40 million Americans.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. And keep in mind that, we don't know who they're voting for. I think it's easy to make extrapolations based on party registration or advantages. And like, people are engaged in this election. They are voting now. It is going to be certainly a record turnout election. And it makes it harder and harder to turn the ship around. I was talking to a Biden aide recently who said Donald Trump has been exactly the same candidate for his entire political career with one exception. And you know this, John. It was the last couple of weeks, last 2 weeks or so of the 2016 campaign, where after Access Hollywood, he decided to be disciplined. And for the only and first time, he kept on a message. And the Biden campaign's fear has been that he would somehow find that discipline and that he would make the last couple of weeks a pure referendum on the economy and make it a choice, frankly, between him and Joe Biden in a clarifying way. I don't see it happening. The debate is, I agree with you, the last best shot to do that. But that it does not seem like the play for Donald Trump. He continues to his calculation, and there's some chance he's right. His calculation is that his understanding of the American electorate, his base plus, is enough to win this thing. And he is going to win or lose the way he has always been.
All right, Rick, let's take a quick break. And we've got H.R. McMaster ready to go. We'll be back in just a moment.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome back to Powerhouse Politics. We are joined now by retired Army General H.R. McMaster, of course, President Trump's former national security advisor, also the author of a new book, Battlegrounds, The Fight to Defend the Free World. General, it's an honor to have you on Powerhouse Politics. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
So I want to ask you a big picture question. We've seen so many people leave the Trump White House and say incredibly scathing things about this president, about the way this president has behaved, about the decisions he has made, about his leadership style. You've been critical. You certainly haven't been anywhere near the most critical. But I just have a big question. It's really more about your colleagues and the people you worked with than about you, although it could apply to you too. Why is it that we really haven't seen anybody resign in protest from this administration, given all the things that have been said about this president by people who worked for him and worked really closely with him? Why is it that for the most part, we heard all this stuff after they left and usually after these individuals were fired or forced out?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I'm just speculating, but maybe it's because he was elected president. I think for me, like, he was the fifth commander in chief that I served. I entered West Point when I was 17 years old. I think everybody should vote. I just want to say that up front, but I chose not to vote while I was on active duty to keep that bold line in place, between the military and politics and partisan politics. I followed the example of General George Marshall. So, for me, it was an easy decision to serve. And I felt like I could make a difference. I could serve the elected president and help him, advance and protect American interests. In the Trump administration, as you mentioned, a number of people get used up in this vitriolic environment there and political environment. And I was at peace with that. Right. I mean, this is my 34th year of service in the military, and I've considered it a privilege to do it. And as I write about in Battlegrounds, hey, none of these problems that we're facing are going away while we're at each other's throats. So I think we all have to probably focus on doing our part to bring our society back together and to try to build a better future for generations of Americans to come.
Well, certainly, in all categories, but particularly on the national security front, I mean, whatever is going on with the president, terrorists are still out there, China's still a rising power, Russia's still doing what they're doing, the Middle East is still a mess. But I wrote about you a bit in my book, Front Row at the Trump Show, and you...
Which, congratulations, by the way, I've got it. I've read in it so far. I will read it more fully, John.
Thank you very much. Well, I wrote, and correct me if this is your chance to tell me if I was wrong, but you were one of those senior advisors in the West Wing who was willing to tell the president to his face when you disagreed with something and make your case. But you also felt it was your duty to carry out the wishes of the commander in chief. After all, as you just pointed out, he's the guy that got elected. But you worked side by side with people, John Kelly, General Mattis, Rex Tillerson, to name a few, who, at least in my telling of it and the way it's been kind of portrayed to me, felt that that their job was to try to basically protect the country from the president, or protect the president in some cases from the president, to protect the president's agenda from his worst instincts, and they would hear him out and then quietly undermine some of the things that they disagreed with. That was decidedly not your approach. How's history going to judge all of this? The people who served Donald Trump.
Yeah. Well, John, I had this great gift, right? I the Army gave me the opportunity to study history. And I wrote a book about how and why Vietnam became an American war called Dereliction of Duty.
Sure.
And what this was about really all the pitfalls associated with national security decision making on the path to making Vietnam an American war. And so it was kind of surreal, the day that I walked into the West Wing, the day after I'd been hired. I didn't even live in Washington, right? So I didn't have like a lot of time to prepare. So, but for me, I was walking into McGeorge Bundy's office, right, who was the national security advisor during Lyndon Johnson's administration. And I was determined, hey, at least I'm going to avoid the same mistakes as McGeorge Bundy did. And the way that I structured our efforts within the National Security Council staff and for the president and across the NSC, which are the principals committee, the president's cabinet, essentially, dealing with national security affairs and foreign policy, it was to present the president with multiple options, plural. In Vietnam, what happened is, people decided, hey, well, Lyndon Johnson wants a strategy for Vietnam that prioritizes his domestic objectives. So let's give that to him. Well, of course, that foreclosed on any kind of a discussion about the long-term costs and consequences of an American war in Vietnam. And so I saw it as my duty to tell the president what he doesn't want to hear, to give the president multiple options. And I knew that probably my shelf life was limited in that connection, but I was at peace with that. There are three types of people, John, I think, and I've mentioned this before, that I think serve in any administration. And the first are those who are determined to give the president multiple options, recognizing, as you stated, hey, this is the man or woman who was elected, right? And to then help assist with the sensible implementation of those decisions, and in this case, across departments and agencies with like-minded partners abroad and so forth. And then the second group of people, I think, are those who define themselves in the role of advancing their own objectives, right? They're not there for the elected president's agenda. They have their own agenda on immigration or trade or whatever it is. And then the third group of people are there who are there to serve what they see as a purpose of saving the country, maybe the world, from the president. The danger with that second and third group is that none of them were elected. And so they're actually undermining the Constitution of the United States, because sovereignty lies with the people. The people spoke in the election. And of course, our founders were brilliant in connection with separation of powers and checks and balances on the executive that lie in the legislature and in the court, right? Not with some political appointee or civil servant who says, like the anonymous writer, the anonymous op-ed writer, hey, look what a great job I did at foiling the elected president's agenda.
But if I can just ask one follow-up on that, though, what do you do in a situation, and you can, it's a matter of judgment whether we're at that point now, but what do you do in a situation if you are there serving a president who was duly elected but has gone bad?
Let me talk about my experience. You were there with me. Yep. We saw each other quite frequently in that 13 months. I did my best to serve the president and the country, right? I swore an oath at age 17 to the Constitution of the United States, right? So I wasn't going to hold back. And you know what, John? I didn't care. I wasn't trying to keep my job. I wasn't trying to get a next job. So when I was done, I was done. But I concluded, as a historian in particular, that the greatest disservice, not only to the country, but also to the president himself, would be if I held back, if I didn't tell him what he didn't want to hear. And so that's what I did for 13 months. And you know what, John, I think we got some pretty good policy outcomes in that 13 months. I can't talk about what happened after, but we effected the most significant shift in U.S. foreign policy since the end of the Cold War. And that's a competitive approach to China rather than a policy of cooperation engagement. We had significant shifts on our approach to Russia, which of course is completely disconnected from the president's public statements about Russia, which is frustrating and counterproductive. But I think we have a sound approach to Iran now, where before it was a flawed approach associated with the Iran nuclear deal as the policy toward Iran. But there have been disappointments, since I left on South Asia and on Afghanistan in particular. But I can only talk about when I was there, right? Mm-hmm. And I think we ran a process, and I think I fulfilled my duties in a way that produced decent foreign policy outcomes. I think if you take that December 2017 national security strategy, and if a new administration does come in on January 20th, I think they should just do a word search for America First, delete that, and then adopt it. I mean, it's not, I mean, you know, for me, John, I don't think foreign policy should be partisan, right? I mean, tell me, first of all, you know, when Al-Qaeda attacked us and committed mass murder and the most devastating terrorist attack in history on September 11th, 2001, they didn't attack Democrats or Republicans. But they attacked Americans, right? And so I think the reason I wrote Battlegrounds is because we should be able to discuss these issues and come together as Americans, right, to build this better future for our children and our grandchildren.
General McMaster, I wanted to hone in a little bit on Russia, which you referenced. And we're obviously 13 days before Election Day. And the consensus view of the intelligence community, and I think most thinking people, is that the Russians are again trying to manipulate the election. That this is a goal of Vladimir Putin. The president has been loath to admit that. And in fact, his campaign is continuing to spread information that, you know, we don't know what the origin was or what the means are, but it has a lot of the hallmarks of potential Russian disinformation with regard to Vice President Biden and his family. Put your historian's hat on. What concerns you about this final stretch to the election? Is there damage that could be done that is serious, is significant beyond the normal political rhetoric that you'd expect from one side or the other?
Yes. So Rick, what we see with Russia and what I describe in Battlegrounds is a strategy of disruption, disinformation, and denial. And what Russia is doing is, I mean, I don't think they care who wins the election as long as we have doubt about the result, right? And what they're trying to do is polarize us on issues of race and you've reported on this, right? I mean, really, you know, 80% of the bot traffic and troll traffic in 2016 was on issues of race. Hey, they picked a winner there, right? As well as gun control and immigration. So they want to polarize us, pit us against each other, and diminish our confidence in who we are as a people, and our confidence in our democratic principles and institutions and processes. And the president and any leader should not give them a better opportunity than they deserve, should not be our own worst enemy. So when you have people, including the president, raise doubts about our electoral process, hey, what the president should be doing is taking credit. Between 2016 and 2018, we got exponentially better at protecting our election process, exponentially better at countering this Russian campaign of disruption, disinformation, and denial. Well, we have new organizations with very capable people working on this. We change policies so we can, you know, so that we can actually, you know, be effective in cyberspace and combine a good defense with a good offense. So, I mean, it's perplexing to me why the president won't be just straight up about the threat from Putin and Russia. You know, by the way, this is something that they've done since the Soviet Union, that's from the 20s. But now they're enabled. They're enabled by cyberspace. They're enabled by our own polarization and divisions on race and other issues, our lack of confidence in our common identity as Americans. And they're enabled by social media as well. And by the way, I should say by the mainstream media too, because, you know, many of these stories that polarize us make it, you know, they jump the gap essentially from the pseudo media and social media into the mainstream media.
Is that in your view dangerous? I mean, I think you get at this in your book and in what you talk about your time under President Trump. We hear from a lot of people that work for him, and a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill. Pay attention to his actions, not his words. You know, if you just look at the policies and you filter out the tweets, then you understand. But is this a case where the words do matter? Where what the president is saying about the integrity of the election, what he's saying about the Russians, matters?
Well, this is an essential part of leading, right? Is to, if you lead a big organization, you know, or a country, you have to send a simple, clear message, I think, to people so that you can bring people together and you can galvanize appropriate action, to take advantage of opportunities or to overcome obstacles and so forth. And we have major threats to our society. And that's, I write about this in Battlegrounds. I write about the need for us to improve our strategic competence, but also to improve our confidence that's I think, you know, a fundamental aspect of what we all ought to take on. And this is why I think the media, the press, I mean, you've got to be part of the solution of bringing this back together. I mean, I think it's kind of crazy, right? It's crazy that if you lean in one political direction, you watch one cable news station. If you lean in the other political direction, you watch one of two others. You know, the social media and the avarice of these companies, you know, really has led them to pursue, you know, a business model based on advertising and clicks that gives you more and more extreme information. So they can get more and more advertising dollars. This is a huge threat to our society, and we all have to come together and restore our confidence. You know, in Battlegrounds, I quote Richard Rorty, who said that national pride, right, or pride is, you know, to nations what self-respect is to individuals, right? A necessary ingredient for self-improvement. We have to restore our pride. We have to restore our confidence. A big part of that is we have to be confident in really common sources of authoritative information. So I think we have to strengthen all of our institutions, right? The, you know, the executive branch, the legislative branch, the judiciary. But heck, we have to strengthen the fourth estate, which is you guys and our media.
Well, we could agree with that. One question, I know you have to go, but one other kind of maybe a big topic here. I'd just like to hear your initial thoughts on how do you deal with disinformation? How do you deal, how should our big social media companies deal with disinformation? We saw Twitter and Facebook, for instance, take steps to prevent users from seeing the New York Post story on Hunter Biden. That was probably a clumsy effort there, but should our big social media companies take on the role essentially of censoring out what they can deem to be disinformation, or is that not a proper role? How do you deal with it?
It's not a proper role. Yeah. And I'm speaking from Palo Alto, right? We do not want my neighbors here to be the arbiters of free speech, right? No way. So what I write about in Battlegrounds are really two solutions to this. One, Rick and John, is education. It's education, right? Education so that we can see disinformation and recognize it for what it is. And so the greatest strength of a nation is an educated populace. That is the purpose of my book. It's the purpose of Battlegrounds is to help the American people understand better the crucial challenges we face. The book was a continuation of my own self-education on these issues. And on the issue of disinformation in particular, it's important for us to have authoritative sources of information. I write about in the book a startup here in Palo Alto called Soap AI. And what basically they do is they go to authoritative sources of information across the political spectrum, and they curate material and essays and reporting that is relevant to a particular issue. So if you're interested in the Biden emails, whatever you're interested in, you can click on that, and then you get a range of views, you know, from think tanks and investigative journalists and mainstream media and so forth. I think that's a way to do it. So instead of censoring all the bad stuff, we should take down malicious enemy activity on the internet, but we should not take down people's opinions. It is our freedom of speech. It is our ability to have a say in how we're governed by voting. That is our greatest strength. You know, one of the chapters in Battlegrounds is on China. And the title of the chapter is Turning Weakness into Strength. Turning what our adversaries perceive as our weaknesses into our greatest strength. And we can do that, I think, through education, as I mentioned. And you know, we have to rely heavily on the press. What I'm concerned about, guys, I think you've seen this, right, is we are so polarized that I think that journalism has suffered as well, right? Journalism has gotten sucked into this vitriolic partisan discourse and is subjected, like we all are, to these centripetal forces that are tearing us apart, right? We have to all do our part to put a brake on those centripetal forces and bring all Americans back together and restore our confidence in who we are and restore confidence in our democratic principles and institutions and processes.
You know, we've been here before, as you well know, as a student of history, when in the early days of our republic, the press turned into warring factions. You had Federalist newspapers and Republican newspapers.
Absolutely.
And you know, and here we are now. I mean, I for one, listeners of the podcast know I tell conservatives, you know, go and pull up a chair and listen to MSNBC in primetime for a little while. I tell liberals and Democrats, tune in to Fox and primetime as well. Just get a sense of what the other side is what universe they're living in,
right?
Because we're living in two different universes.
Yeah, we are. But no, hey, I would just like to say though, but remember the debates in that period of time. I mean, read the Federalist Papers, but then read the Anti-Federalist Papers. These were meaningful,
yep,
thoughtful debates, and we're missing that substance these days. I mean, I think that our founders were right, because they feared these factions, and we all have the responsibility, mm-hmm, to correct this. You're right; it's not unprecedented. As an American historian, we never say anything is unprecedented.
Right.
And so I have confidence. I have confidence in our country. We're going to get through this, and we're going to emerge stronger. And thanks to both of you for having a forum in which you can have long format discussions and explore these issues in some depth. I appreciate you guys, and thanks for the opportunity to be with you.
Well, I hope we can talk to you again soon. Keep up the conversation. One last final quick one. Are you going to vote? You said you, as an active duty military officer, you did not vote. So is that going to change now?
I did. I voted for the first time in my life. Yes. Yes, I did.
Wow. is that a secret ballot, or have you revealed who you voted for?
Again, I think everybody should vote. The reason I didn't,
yep,
is because I think it's so important to keep this bold line. This, again, go back to our founders, right? George Washington's grandparents fled the English Civil War, right? And so our founders had in mind the vital importance of keeping this bold line between the military and partisan politics, and that's why. But of course, I voted now, and we'll continue to vote, and we'll never tell anyone ever how I voted.
Okay, well, there you go. That was the answer to my question. General H.R. McMaster, thank you very much. The book, again, is Battlegrounds, The Fight to Defend the Free World. An honor to talk to you, sir. Thank you.
Hey, the honor's mine. Thanks, you guys. Take care.
Thank you, General.
All right, Rick, that is all the time we have, because we've got to get down to Nashville. We've got a presidential debate, I think, the final one.
It's happening.
I, you know, I'll actually believe it when I see them both on the stage, but it's apparently happening. And we will, hopefully we could do some kind of an emergency podcast post-debate, but we will be back sooner than you think. Thank you to Avery Miller, Trevor Hastings, and the entire Powerhouse Politics team. Talk to you soon.